Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. Our guest today is Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, Director of the Defense Health Agency. My co-host today from IBM is Mark Newsom. So, Admiral, one of the biggest issues, and you've mentioned this earlier, in healthcare is bending the cost curve. What are you doing to slow or reduce ever-increasing healthcare costs for the military medicine? And how does the performance improvement around military treatment facilities factor into doing this?
I think that's probably the most pivotal piece of bending that cost curve. And one of the things that we're looking at is, as we look at our military treatment facilities, we have to ask, have we optimized where we've put or where we've invested the majority of our resources? Mm-hmm. So first you have to find where you've invested all your resources. They tend to be in our large MTFs, our large military treatment facilities. They tend to be in areas where we have a significant, sizable patient population. And when you look there, then you start asking questions like, how are we delivering the care? How often are we seeing the benefit that we expected to get from that? How responsive are we to our patients' needs? And how well are we, or how mindful are we, of what it costs us to actually do this? And I think that one of the things that is a new perspective that we have to develop is understanding that cost is not an independent variable. And it's a little challenging because our financial system is not necessarily the commercial type, fee-for-service and billing and all that. So it's a closed system. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at things in a similar business-like way to understand where our costs are going and what's driving those costs. So I've become very in tune with margins and what that means and you know, opportunity costs and things. But a lot of that comes down to how well we run the MTFs. Do we know what our actual capacity is? Have we fully made that capacity available to our patients, and what are we doing to make sure that our patients have access to our facilities? And then the plan part, the TRICARE health plan, is how well have we created a system that's integrated between the direct care, the military treatment facilities, and the purchase care, the managed care support contract? How well have we created that continuum of care? So, I mean, I actually see that integration on several different levels. How well are we integrating care with our patients? How responsive are we to what's valuable to them? How well have we integrated care across Army, Air Force, Navy? Because in many of our areas, we have several facilities, but they're managed and owned by the different services. How well have we integrated across that? And then how well do we integrate our care across the direct care and the purchase care? And then how well then are we now integrating our system to support readiness and health?
With NDAA being a sort of rudder for the agency, what other reforms are required and are being pursued by the Defense Health Agency as outlined in the most recent NDAA? Can you expound also on your emphasis remarks of how this alignment will improve readiness, decisions, budgeting, and standardization?
First off, I am extremely grateful that Congress really put so much into the NDAA. When you take a look at the Title VII of the NDAA 2017 and you step back and don't try to see each of the sections as individual, you actually see a system that's being described, and sure, everything nests within each other. I found it very logical. And so I'm very appreciative of Congress being able to do that for the military health system. And I do feel that that's going to have a profound impact on our beneficiaries. But I think that your point, Mark, about how does this help readiness is extremely important. I mean, because that's why we are here. That's what the military health system is how do we preserve that readiness? And not only do we preserve it, how do we catapult it to that next level? So this is probably one of the most impactful things that we can do to create a higher state of readiness. And I say that because we have such a keen appreciation across the enterprise that our readiness is actually multifactorial. It doesn't just happen when a doctor comes in or a nurse comes in and puts on a uniform. That's a part of it, but that's not the only part of it. And so if we're looking at what are some of the attributes, what are the characteristics of readiness that we need to consider and how is the best way to address it, then you start looking at things like, well, how is our education and training occurring? How do we do that? How do we make sure that if we're paying attention to what's going on in that military environment, do we have the right kind of training? Are we sure about the effectiveness of the training, and how are we measuring that? How are we constantly assessing that? And how do we know that we're preparing our folks to function in a particular way, in a successful way, depending on the domain that they've been deployed to? So we can start looking at education and training and figuring out, you know, is that the best way? And are there other things that we should be considering, like, you know, modeling and simulation? How does that fit in then to where we might need to be downrange? So that's one of the things. And I think the Defense Health Agency, as the agency that supports education and training, would be something that would have an impact on readiness. The other piece, and I'd mentioned it earlier, is how do we make sure that we're supplying the right types of equipment that we can deploy with? And so since logistics is part of the portfolio of the DHA, then we can also start looking at what are some of the best types of medical devices that we want to be able to make available when we go downrange. The other thing is, and this brings in our role as a combat support agency, we look to see what are some of the things that the combatant commands need and what are some of the challenges they have. And this is where we start getting into the conversation about how do we resupply the equipment or the assemblages that are used in these various combatant commands. And how do we make sure that we have the right kind of system in order to provide that? We also look at their specific training that they need in the COCOMs, mm-hmm. and that's something that we can support and make sure that that's being delivered in a standardized way, and reducing that variability that oftentimes drive costs and changes outcomes, right? Certainly. So I think those are just a few of those examples, but I think that this has been one of those things that I see is actually going to enhance our ability to be ready and to be able to do it in a way that we continue to, you know, contribute to our own efficiency and identify those places where we can recapitalize.
Regarding the visible wounds of war, the integration of services is producing results. The invisible wounds have been a bit more challenging. Can you tell us more about DHA's effort to support returning soldiers with traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress? How are you working with civilian medicine to address those challenges and these issues? And what are some of those challenges that are being faced?
You know, I think the biggest challenge right now is understanding how complex this is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually one of the most profound lessons learned about the invisible wounds of war, mm-hmm. is it's not a one-for-one, and it's not the same for everybody. I mean, in our efforts to better treat it, we've learned that there's a diversity within traumatic brain injury that we had not yet appreciated. Rightfully so, as we've explored different types of treatment options, we've realized that there's just a lot of nuance into this condition. It's not just a matter of having a bad head injury or a concussion and then, you know, feeling better afterwards. And I think that this is something that other communities and other populations are also starting to appreciate, you know, and I think you see that with that heightened awareness in sports, mm-hmm. you know, for children, or what's going on in college level activities, and certainly in professional sports. So I think there's a growing awareness that we have to be more mindful about this, and that sometimes these correlations that we've been working on are not directly one for one. So not only are we developing a greater appreciation for the complexity of this condition, I think our ability to talk about it more openly and to share our experience with other the civilians and other organizations and other schools and institutions can only be helpful, because I think that we have to be able to look at the data and understand what it's telling us, but we have to have sufficient data to be able to drive or discern the patterns. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can get that type of data is if we're collaborating with everybody else. But it does remain a challenge. And I think that the other part of it that I've become sensitized to is that these invisible wounds of war are not only to the member, but to the family. Mm-hmm. And so how prepared are we, and how well do we support the rest of the family, because that is one of the things that we learned during while we were treating our wounded warriors, is that it is definitely a multidisciplinary effort. But a large part of that is how well we incorporate the family and the network of a patient into their overall recovery. So we need to be able to pay attention to those second and third order consequences.
Mm-hmm. Leads into my next question around the opioid crisis. And the military, your service members, their families aren't immune to this. What are you doing in this area to address it? And, you know, I found it fascinating doing research for the interview where you candidly state that, you know, the opioid addiction is a preventable disease. Yes. And how does going beyond traditional pain management important in this area?
It's extremely important. And yes, it is a preventable disease. You know, I'm borrowing something from Admiral Carmona, who was one of our former U.S. Surgeon Generals. He said he was a recovering trauma surgeon. I'm a recovering, I know. And that was the recognition that trauma is a preventable disease.
That's interesting.
And so opioid addiction is a preventable disease. And so that really then, and being able to take that stance allows me then to lean forward mm-hmm. into some of those areas that you're asking about. So first off, we are part of that effort that the previous administration, President Obama, started with mental health parity and making sure that, first off, that we recognize that there is that element that may be in play here. Secondly, understanding that substance use disorder is part of that treatment plan that we need to make sure that we're giving access to and that we're providing the right level of care to substance use disorder. It's not just a period of time where you prevent somebody from mm-hmm. taking. It's a whole lot of other pieces that need to be addressed. The other thing is we've made sure that our providers undergo training so that they can make sure and understand the impact that their actions in treating a patient and pain management might have on a particular patient. And then finally, we're looking at a lot of different tools that allow us to monitor. Mm-hmm. This is very fascinating. Looking at patients' profiles in terms of the types of medications they've been prescribed, as well as looking at the prescribing practices of providers and understanding where those two types of behaviors may indicate,
red flag.
Yes, yeah. A higher propensity for an opioid problem. So the other piece that we've done, too, is we recognize there's a growing recognition, and I know that Admiral Winnefeld had sent out a very passionate description of his own personal experience. And one of the things that he had pointed out is the need to have more therapy or more treatment available for dual diagnosis. And that's, you know, if there's a behavioral health diagnosis as well as a substance use disorder. And I'm so happy to report that now in our TRICARE health plan, we're able to provide assistance and care and coverage for those folks who have a dual diagnosis. And we're actively going out to seek those centers that treat dual diagnoses to become a part of our TRICARE network, because we realize that is a piece of our responsibility and our commitment to the care of our beneficiaries. So I think that it is a very serious issue. You can look at the stats of people overdosing, and those numbers they outnumber car accidents.
Yeah, you know,
yes, and like I said, it is preventable, but it is a multi-pronged piece. We have to look at our system. We have to look at our providers. We have to look at our patients. And then we have to make sure that we've got the right stopgaps in place so that we can put a pause on some of this and say, is this really the right solution here? And then on the other side of that is when we have this as an issue, then are we providing the most, you know, the most comprehensive and contemporary care that's available out there?
So you mentioned earlier the Defense Health Agency is a combat support agency, and I'd like to delve a little bit into that. What is being done to enhance DHA's ability to serve operational needs of combatant commanders, and how is it maturing in this area?
So this is actually kind of a new role for us in the military health system, but I think it's a very important role. First, it's important to understand that the services, Army, Air Force, Navy, they remain the force providers. They're the ones that actually provide the troops whenever there's a call for medical support in a contingency operation. With the Defense Health Agency, though, since we actually report to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we look to see what can we provide to the combatant commands that are in direct support for their operations. And so what we've done is not only look to see what the chairman's strategy is for the national military strategy, we actually go out to the combatant commands and say, what are some of the medical pieces that you feel need to be either enhanced, improved, or taken out that, you know, that would impact your operations and what your plans are for this particular theater. And by doing that and finding out what their needs are, we've been able to identify certain elements. Training was a big one. The blood products, making sure we had blood products, the assemblages, and that's the equipment sets that go out there. There was a variety of things that were a surprise to us, but until we asked the question, we didn't know that that was a need. So we have recently undergone what we call the Combat Support Agency Review Team, CSART, which is a way of assessing the effectiveness of a combat support agency. And I was extremely proud that, you know, within 2 years of us standing up, we were having our first CSART. And overall, I'm still waiting for the final report on that, but found it very gratifying that our direct interaction with the combatant commands and understanding what their identified needs were and us looking to see what kind of skills, resources, functions and capabilities that we have, we were able to turn that into more comprehensive support in areas that they needed that. So this is, I believe, it's going to become a growing role mm-hmm. because as the chairman talks about being an integrator, I see the Combat Support Agency or Defense Health Agency being an integrator through our Combat Support Agency role.
You've talked about talent in the DHA DNA. What is DHA doing to ensure that its professional workforce and clinicians are properly trained and highly skilled? Can you share how the people of DHA have been pivotal to the mission success, the culture, and the DHA guiding principles?
The people of the DHA are, I mean, I know I might be a little biased, but they are the best. I mean, they truly are. I send out a weekly email to the staff in the DHA. And I invariably get one or two responses that come right back to me, you know, and it's just my way of keeping in touch. And I have been over and over again just impressed with the talent and the professionalism and the commitment and dedication that we have in the people of the Defense Health Agency. My commitment to them in return is how do I help advance whatever their personal and professional goals are? And how do I create the conditions for them to be as successful as many times as possible? So what I like to do then is look to see within the DHA, what are some of my communities that I want to make sure we're giving them access to the things that will help advance their career? One of the great examples is I look at our acquisition personnel. And I understand, too, that in order for them to continue to compete in a very favorable way, then I need to make sure they have access to certain types of education and training that continue to allow them to maintain a level of proficiency in the acquisition environment. Now, I know part of the risk is that, you know, I give them that higher level and somebody else will want them. But I think that's a compliment because, you know, I want people to see the Defense Health Agency as a springboard for wherever they're going next. And so I take that same approach with the military members that rotate at the Defense Health Agency. I want that experience to be professionally and personally and career-wise rewarding. And I want them to see that as a way to acquire additional skills, additional knowledge, additional insights that they can then leverage when they either go back to the services or go into another joint environment. I've looked at it through the clinical lens as well. You know, how do we make sure that folks are getting the top of the line training that's most contemporary, that where that leading edge of technology is taking us? But this is a give and take. My ability to support where they're going and their success is my success. And so I try to be as engaged as I can. I do have an open door to policy. I'm sure my front office just wished I hadn't said that. I try to be accessible to as many people as possible because they are the key to us being able to do what we're doing in the Defense Health Agency. I think the growth we've experienced since I've come there as the director in the last 2 years is far beyond what anybody projected. And it couldn't have happened were it not for the people that I have around me at the Defense Health Agency. They are incredible.
One last question, Vice Admiral Bono, is what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service, military service, or even medicine?
You know, do it. Do it. You won't be disappointed. I personally feel that having a military career or having any type of military service is one of the most liberating and growth experiencing event that you'll ever have. Being able to combine public service with my own medical background and then being able to evolve into some kind of leadership capability. I don't think I would have gotten that same opportunity anywhere else. I know I'm extremely biased to that, but I think that the other part of this is no matter how long a person comes in to serve in the military, it leaves an indelible mark on you, and that indelible mark is something that others will recognize and will be drawn to. Mm-hmm. So I think that that. If people are considering that, I mean, of course, I'm in a Navy uniform. I would say go Navy. But I think any military exposure and experience is valuable. It's extremely valuable. And I'll tell you the other piece about being in the military that I've personally found is that it is the one arena where I've consistently seen that people get advanced based on the merit of their performance. And so I think that when you're able to show that ability to advance within a system where it is strictly on merit, I would hope that someone would realize or come away with a very deep-seated sense of satisfaction and confidence. And I think that's what a career or a job or time spent in the military has done for many people. I know it has for me. So I would advise people. And I would also say, you know, if I can do it, they can too.
Certainly.
So I would invite people to consider the military as a career.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. And wonderful answers, great conversation. But more importantly, Mark and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. It really is my honor. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, Director of the Defense Health Agency. My co-host from IBM has been Mark Newsom. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.